Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
Now I think we're really in that world where you are making decisions whose ramifications and secondary trade-offs spread throughout societies. These are techno-social systems. And that's what we're tinkering with. And at least throughout my life, regardless of whether I think I know what the key issues are with any technology, I've sat in thousands of talks where somebody who's really parsing it comes up with things that I've never even considered as being central.
My name is Brian Patrick Green. I am the Director of Technology Ethics at the Markela Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, a longtime supporter and research fellow with AI and Faith, and I will be your podcast host today. This episode is an interview with renowned bioethicist and AI ethicist Wendell Wallach, recorded in September of 2025. In this interview, we discuss how Wendell became involved in the ethics of emerging technologies, the connection between bioethics and AI ethics, and his ideas for ways to improve contemporary discourse on the ethics of emerging technologies, including his new work on what he calls trade-off ethics and the silent ethic. Listen now to our conversation. It's a real pleasure to be here today, especially to have Wendell Wallach joining us. I'm just going to read Wendell's bio, which is pretty extensive because he's done some pretty amazing stuff over the course of his career. Wendell Wallach is an internationally renowned expert on the ethics and governance of emerging technologies, particularly artificial intelligence and biotechnologies. He has been a Carnegie a Hero Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, where he founded and co-directed the AI and Equality Initiative. He's also senior advisor to the Hastings Center and scholar at the Yale University Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics, where he chaired technology and ethics studies for 11 years. He's a scholar at the Lincoln Center for Applied Ethics and fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. He received the World Technology Award for Ethics in 2014 and for Journalism and Media in 2015. He was appointed Fulbright Research Chair at the University of Ottawa in 2015-16. The World Economic Forum appointed Mr. Wallach co-chair of its Global Future Council on Technology, Values, and Policy in 2016-2018. Wallach is also a fellow at the Center for Law and Innovation at the Sandra Day O'Connor School of Law at Arizona State University. And most importantly, Wendell was visiting professor at Santa Clara University in 2018, which is where I met him for the first time. He's the author of A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control, and co-authored with Colin Allen, Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right from Wrong. Previously, Wallach was founder and president of two computer consulting companies, Farpoint Solutions and Omnia Consulting, Inc. While semi-retired, he continues to accept speaking engagements like this one. Welcome, Wendell Wallach. Thank you so much for being here this morning. Tell us about your background and how you got involved in ethics of emerging technologies.
I'm very much a 60s person. I went through that whole period. I had various, iconic experiences during the 60s, but I also had what some people like to think of as a spiritual awakening. I went to India for about 2.5 years. I functioned as a spiritual mentor and ended up starting computer consulting companies. And I realized I'd gotten into the computer industry because I wanted to get a few books out of my head. And I also realized at the time that I was a bit behind on some of the things that were happening in cognitive science and emerging technologies more broadly. So I joined the Yale Bioethics Center, various programs, including one on emerging tech. And after about 3 years, I was made chair of that. That was a period so early on that we were kind of one of the go-to forums for the various people in everything from nanotech to geoengineering. In fact, I followed in the chairing of that, I followed Nick Bostrom, whose name a lot of you will know. And at that time, that was also kind of a side ballywick of the World Transhumanist Association. So when I got into all of this, which was around 2001, there were probably 250 people in the world who could have cared about any of these subjects. And 50% of them were transhumanists. And they were mainly concerned that government would not put its hands in a way that would interfere with their ability to experiment with the latest innovation. Now, they also had overly optimistic assumptions about when all of that would come. That included everything from brain-mind interfaces to radical life extension to nanomachines running around in your bloodstream. Very little of which has happened so far.
Fantastic. One of the things that you've been known for is both biotechnology and AI. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see AI and biotechnology being connected to each other?
AI is clearly the amplifier and driver of all technologies. That's not to say that there are not things going on in biotech that could not happen without AI. But even in modifying germ cells, you see AI helping researchers figure out which germ cell they want to modify so that they can see what has been created. But the difficulty is that we are in this dangerous position of amplifying the speed of development in biotechnologies to a degree where we may see too many organisms released into the wild that have a detrimental impact on various environments. So that's one thing I'm particularly concerned about. Another thing which I'm less concerned about, but it's been a longstanding concern, has been designer babies. And I think when we found out that there was probably only 20 to 25,000 genes around 2000, that was bad news because it meant that all traits, all characteristics were not gene specific. And therefore, what's going on, particularly in terms of how proteins are affecting development, is much more complex than we had hitherto appreciated. So that's going to mean that if people want to start experimenting with trying to capture particular traits, they're really going to need AI to help them discern which combinations are salient to look at. We're not looking as much at single gene diseases as we were in those early days.
You were involved in the FLI Asilomar conference. Can you say a little bit about that Asilomar conference and comparing it to the initial Asilomar conference that everyone seems to want to be kind of trying to recreate?
Yeah, and that's why they actually schedule it there. And BrainMind is actually scheduling a conference at Asilomar this spring. So they're less ambitious in terms of getting a code of ethics out of that than they were initially when they looked at Asilomar. So the original Asilomar conference was pretty technology specific. It had a task, and David Baltimore, who actually passed away this past year, I believe, David Baltimore put it together to try and get a code of safety out of the key researchers so that they would not be doing seriously detrimental things when they were doing recombinant DNA. And so the specificity of that was also the success of that. They got agreement on a code of ethics. And therefore, for many people who have absolutely no idea what happened at that conference, that's an emblazoned the Asilomar conference as being this great event. FLI actually had their second meeting at Asilomar. Their first one was, we were all in Puerto Rico. And there were about 89 of us. And it included a lot, most of the key figures in AI. As I recall, Jim Moore and I were the only people who had specific ethical philosophical backgrounds who were at that conference. But, you know, we did have others who had specific ethical issues. We had all four founders at that time of DeepMind. We had Maggie Boden, another person who passed away this year. You know, some of the historical figures in cognitive science and AI there. But most of the usual names you would expect, Stuart Russell, Max Tegmark. The output of that was actually Elon Musk giving $6 million that then FLI distributed to about 36 different grant proposals. And I got one of those grant proposals. I got some of that funding to run some workshops over 3 years with Stuart Russell, which we did at the Hastings Center. So for those of you who are submersed in the bioethics side of this conversation, you'll know the Hastings Center, because that's where, for all practical purposes, bioethics started. There's debate over where the name came from, but it's pretty clear that Dan Callahan and the people there were doing that. And at FLI in acrylamide, they doubled that number. I think there was like 170 or 80 people at that conference. So it was truly a who's who in the area of AI. And there were a few more ethicists and social scientists at that gathering. And they had done some advanced work collecting all of the codes of ethics that had been developed for AI by that time. And they went through a process of trying to cull them and hone them and then do votes, you know, edit them in the middle and then do votes on which of those were accepted. So they had their code of ethics that came out of that. I thought, in terms of what was new there, was the looking at a lot of conditions under which artificial superintelligence research was acceptable, which was very interesting, given that there were people there like Eliezer Yudkowsky, who many of you may have noticed, If They Build It, We Will Die, he and Nate Suarez's book, which has just come out, that were among the people there. So it was a relatively early conference. So we're still in this period where there are people like Eliezer who always wanted to flag the dangers of superintelligence. But most people were pretty naive about it at that time. And I think the concern was more about protecting research than about flagging the dangers of research. Now, one of the interesting things about that period was, let me see if I can get the timings all correct. So we had deep learning in around 2012. I think that acrylamide conference was around 2015. No, the Puerto Rican one was around 2015. And that was called specifically because there was a lot of research on technological unemployment, but also DeepMind and others were starting to become concerned about where deep learning might lead. Again, there were relatively few people, other than those who wanted to tap on the superintelligence side of things, who were critical of AI. So I was sort of sitting on the wire, shall we say. I always say traversing the razor's edge of ambiguity. But I had been then for a decade already flagging things that could go wrong. And the interesting thing about things that could go wrong, I remember the very first AI for Good conference, I'm giving you probably more history than most of you really want to know, which was at the ISU in the UNO. I think my colleague Anya Pearson and I, who are kind of prominent in that first AI for Good conference, we noted that we may have been the only people at that conference who raised critical questions about AI. The AI for Good people had really taken over. But as you have all been witnessing for the last decade or so, there's probably been an expansion of the critical concerns that AI gives rise to. They've been expanding just about as fast as the undesirable concerns. And I think now we're perhaps teetering into undesirable as taking over desirable, but I could talk more about how I've seen that unfold.
Yeah, well, I think that's actually a great lead in there. Just to probe a little bit deeper on that, can you talk a little bit about the desirable and undesirable and how you see the proportion of them changing?
Well, I think the proportion of them changing just is that there's more and more things that people are pointing out to. I have a slide that I put up that has the 15 major issues, you know, and they go all the way from existential risks to, let's say, the amount of scams that we're all receiving and how that's going up exponentially. So the risks are expanding into so many different areas, not just social media. It's, of course, lethal autonomy, but it's also whether AI will be deployed responsibly by militaries. There are others that I'm sure we'll touch upon before we're done here, but they go all the way, of course, from wiping out humanity to headaches for individuals. But I think, for example, I've been a proponent for years of international governance for AI. And I think one of the places we could start would be to have a ban on scams, which would have to be an international ban because, as all of you know, Nigeria has been a central source for spams for at least 50 years now, going back to the beginning of email, I would say.
All right. I think we are probably going to touch on some more of those points right now. One of the things that you've been talking about recently are kind of the shortcomings in contemporary ethics. So we've talked about the historical background. We've talked a little bit about the technology itself. Tell us about the shortcomings of contemporary ethics and what you think some solutions might be to those shortcomings that you see.
Let me start from the very big picture. Institutions are failing right and left. And among those institutions that's failing is ethics. And why it's failing, we can argue about that on a lot of fronts, but I think it's contributed to what Habermas used to call a delegitimation crisis, where people have lost faith in their institutions, but not only their institutions, in individuals who they have faith in to give them straight feedback. And some of that has to do with ethics. Some of that has to do with deontological ethics and the fact that we are having more and more complicated ethical challenges to meet in which there is a convergence of values. And simple deontology, simple rule-based, is not adequate. So you get deep into the differences in priority, prioritizing values, and whether that leads you anywhere. Consequentialism has the same problem in the consequentialist values. Very few people. Number one consequentialist, Peter Singer, I'm sure does very little other than a rudimentary judgment on what is good for the greatest number without looking at all the various options and trade-offs that exist. So I'm of the belief that we're increasingly confronting ethical challenges that require sometimes deep dialogue, and sometimes people with deep wisdom, neither of which we're seeing a lot of, but it's not like we aren't seeing some deep dialogue. And I'm of the mind that our species is not going to survive this transition in history without an evolutionary leap forward, both in ethical judgment and in self-understanding. And let me start with the self-understanding part first, because people don't think about that perhaps as much, but we've entered into an age where everything is pushing our buttons. And all the machine really needs to know is what are your buttons? And as has been often said, the machine may know you better than you know yourself. So do you have the self-understanding to know when your buttons are being pushed? And how deep does your self-understanding go? For example, if you were being manipulated according to your religious beliefs, would you recognize that? Do you recognize those as part of your condition? And do you have the courage to do the kind of spiritual inquiry that is not dependent upon your having dogmatic beliefs? Not that there's anything wrong with them. Not that they haven't guided us at many times in our life, but that's also a layer of our conditioning. So I think that's number one. Number two is the evolution in ethical understanding. And I think we first of all have to understand, and I think we do understand at least, that there are no absolutes in ethics. But we also have to understand that we don't always have the information we need, that values conflict, that consequentialism doesn't always give us the full picture. And so I have proposed two of what I call process principles of evolution. And the one I call trade-off ethics, and I think trade-off ethics will be pretty simple for everyone to understand. And that is that it's not enough to pick the greatest good for the greatest number, but we also have to look at the trade-offs of the various courses of action and weigh the risks of each of those trade-offs and whether we have the tools to ameliorate those trade-offs. All of that has to come into, all that has to be factored into our judgment. Now, that's a pretty heavy computational load, and we can come back to that on ways to deal with that load, but that's as hard as just making a deep consequentialist judgment. The second piece of this I call a silent ethic, and a silent ethic jumps out at people who have deep spiritual backgrounds or have been involved in sports medicine or flow or a whole flock of other psychological movements that we have seen over the last 50 years. And I hope it jumps out for some of you, but it maybe won't for all of you. And the point has been that many people, whether they're spiritual seekers or want to maximize their potential, come to understand in some way or other that the doorway to all of that is a relatively quiet mind. And a quiet mind does not mean a repressed mind. It means a mind that's relatively free of thought and thinking. And what I don't think anybody has ever looked at, or at least said, is that that quiet can actually be used for us in making decisions. You don't get quiet directly. That's the other thing all deep seekers or meditators learned. I've been meditating for more than 50 years now. It's the byproduct of attending to and solving the challenge at hand. But oftentimes the challenge at hand is which of alternative courses of action to take. And the silent ethic basically says, as you're going through that process, move toward the decisions that give you more inner quiet, less chatter. Now, a few people have noticed when I mention the silent ethic and trade-off ethics that these two are complementary. One focuses a little bit more on individual psychology. The other one is probably best practiced in group decision-making, deciding on issues that transcend individual needs.
My question then, to build on these two ideas that you put forward, are tell us a little bit about how they engage the conversation on the ethics of emerging technologies as you see it.
Well, the ethics of emerging technologies on the side of trade-off ethics, I think, should be pretty apparent. Issues around modification of the genome, particularly the human genome, they aren't simple. And it's not that they're difficult just because people have deep felt convictions which are contradictory, but there are actually so many different factors that come into play. People who are new to the discussion don't necessarily, for example, think about the legacy that will leave the child who is a product of gene selection, you know, just to mention one of many, or if gene selection gets into radical life extension, the legacy to the society that has more and more super seniors. So you aren't making a decision just about whether you modify a specific genome. And of course, now that we know most conditions are not gene specific, it's also what else gets altered in the process. In the early days, it was much easier. But now I think we're really in that world where you are making decisions whose ramifications and secondary trade-offs spread throughout societies. These are techno-social systems. And that's what we're tinkering with. And at least throughout my life, regardless of whether I think I know what the key issues are with any technology, I've sat in thousands of talks where somebody who's really parsing it comes up with things that I'd never even considered as being central. So I think that's the most specific way in which emerging tech comes into trade-off ethics, at least. Another interesting way is computers, regardless of whether they ever have consciousness or superintelligence or any of that, may actually be helpful in us working through the computational load at looking at the many highways and byways we might go down. The computers aren't going to get us more than, you know, two or three levels below the first trade-offs anyways, you know, because obviously we're talking about so many factors coming into play that the trade-offs become exponential very quickly. I think that's an interesting thing about using AI to help us work through and maybe speed up the process. I mean, the way I think about it is having a table at which you bring together many experts. Some of them may even be computers or robots, or at least computers that other experts are gifted at working with. Who knows? Some may be transhuman beings who are part human, part computer. The silent ethic is a little bit more complicated because I'm very suspicious of technology. In fact, you will notice that both of these evolutionary leaps forward I've mentioned do not require either drugs or gene editing. There are more shifts in understanding by the individual about what good decision-making is. And so in the silent ethic, you know, I'm a little suspicious of the technology. I think if you equate silence with certain brainwave patterns, that might help you know if, as you're considering different options, which seem to elicit the positive brainwave. But I think for people who even think this is kind of a practical method forward, they probably have enough understanding of their own inner life that they'll be able to do the navigation without relying on the technology. And I get very concerned when the technology moves toward repressing thought and thinking. In everything we're talking about these days, from neuroethics to AI, the repression of thought and thinking may be actually the greatest danger. And the fact that by technological means, for example, I would say 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when I first got into this field, I said the number one thing for transhuman experimentation is that it did not interfere with the individual's ability or willingness to take responsibility for their actions.
Can you say a little bit more about that? Sounds fascinating. I want to hear more what you see as being this. First of all, the repression of thinking as being the greatest risk, but also what you were just saying about refusal to take responsibility.
Well, repression of thinking goes way back. I mean, it's the number one problem in meditation. You get this idea that there are particular states of mind you want to get to, and that your thoughts are getting in the way. And the first thing everybody tries to is, how do I stop this thinking? Will this mantra do? Will Vipassana work? And, you know, after a few years, if it takes that long, you catch on that almost any tool you use is just trying to mask thinking or repress it. And therefore, it's not allowing our inner processes to come to rest in a natural way, nor reveal why, you know. I mean, one interesting question for a meditator is, what is this thought and what does it want? What are all these thoughts and what do they want? Because you get into a metaphysical dimension very quickly too. How is this world structured and what's the function of thought and thinking and when is it a good thing and when is it distraction? So I think when that comes in, that also opens up an appreciation for what we humans are and the breadth of our possibilities. And even though we may only realize a minor sliver of the breadth of those possibilities, we understand that the access to those possibilities is central to human dignity. And anything that gets in the way of that, by either trying to manipulate our beliefs or by helping us to repress thought patterns, I always want to get a little careful here because I sometimes move into the Thanatos discussion, is a form of evil. My definition of evil is pretty close to Augustine's. It's the movement toward nothingness. The deep question for everybody is, are we just machines? Well, if we're turned into just machines, then that's about as close as we can get to nothingness and still be breathing. And what makes us remarkable is, yes, we are machines, but we have the capacity to transcend our machineness, including our conditioning, including our belief systems, when they are really mechanical responses to the challenge at hand rather than the perception and engagement of the moment.
That's really fascinating. What do you think is the role for religious people as one aspect, but also religious institutions in this kind of conversation on ethics and emerging technologies? I think you've listed a whole bunch of interesting touch points so far, but let's just kind of go there specifically. What do you see as the connection point or some opportunities for thinking about these things from a religious perspective?
That's a tough one. I mean, I'm agnostic about religion. I don't subscribe to any church anymore. I was very active in the United Church of Christ when I was a youngster. I get very concerned when religions are telling people what to think. But I think religions are also the place where most people go when they encounter phenomena in their life, whether it's experiences or questions that deeply concern them. So religions are the place where that can be nurtured. And I have met many a clergy in my life who I think is a marvelous nurturer of the questions as opposed to a proselytizer of belief systems. One of my good friends these days is a woman named Bit of Crabtree, who we were state officers in Connecticut Pilgrim Fellowship together as youngsters. But I've gone to a few of her services now. She became a pastor in the United Church of Christ. And I think she is remarkable at infesting her sermons with the questions that a person needs to address, and not just the theology. Of course, there's all the God and Jesus Christ and everything, and whether that God or that Jesus Christ exists or not, that's a very different question. But I still see that for people who are within the womb of a church, if the churches help them think and help them learn how to stand on their own feet and help them learn when and where spiritual resources are available and when they aren't, that's a great mission. It's a great ministry.
That's fantastic.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.